Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-30475, Ka'upulehu Land LLC versus Heirs and Assigns of Pahukula. Arguing for the petitioner, Jerry M. Hyatt. Also appearing for the petitioner are Seema Muller. Arguing for the respondent, David Copper. Also appearing for the respondent, Alan T. Murakami. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Hyatt and Mr. Copper and our other attorneys. Are you both ready to proceed? Justice McKenna had a matter she wanted to mention to the parties before we begin.
Okay, as I was preparing for this case, I realized that I am a member of the Executive Board of the Judiciary History Center. Several months ago, a Brandy McDougall was also appointed to that board. I do not know if it is the same Brandy McDougall. I have been in two meetings with her, I think, over the course of the last 6 months. I do not believe this would affect my ability to be impartial in my decision-making in this case, but I wanted to inform the parties and ask if there's any concerns with respect to that.
Your Honor, thank you for making the disclosure. There's no concerns as far as...
Thank you.
Mr. Copper? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Justice McKenna. And Mr. Hyatt, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Copper, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Well, please proceed, Mr. Hyatt. This is an appeal from a grant of summary judgment. As I understand it, the standard of this court's review of the matter is de novo, the same as that review was before the ICA. I'm a proud graduate of UH Law School. I've got a couple of points I wanted to make that are policy points before we get into the facts, and they are these. I'm unashamed to ask this court to look at the context of a case like this from a trial court. This case was about ready for trial when it was decided on summary judgment. It was decided on summary judgment by Elizabeth Stranis. She's an experienced trial court judge. It was granted in a context where both sides admitted on the record, and we cited to you those portions of the transcript, that there were no further facts that could be brought forth. They were all in the record before the court at the time she decided the motion. So, as a policy matter,
didn't you just say it was de novo review?
Yes. Yes. And it is de novo review, so that's why I'm couching this in policy terms.
Does policy trump de novo?
I think that it should be borne in mind because of the job that you have and the way that you administer the court system. The fact is that when a case which is, and if this case is right, then the summary judgment should be affirmed. That's my only point. Because not doing so sends the tremor that you all are aware of through the lower courts. That tremor is, you know, my goodness, if a case like that is, you can't get summary judgment on a case like that, then you can't. It taxes the parties with the cost of a trial, which in our society at this time is huge.
Mr. Hyatt, what's your response to the ICA's argument that the facts could reasonably be interpreted to support either party's contention with regard to whether this property had been conveyed or not prior to the probate proceeding?
And I'm going to get into that because my response in a nutshell
But would you agree that if the facts could interpret either, could support either interpretation, then summary judgment would not be appropriate?
Yep. I'm not going to answer. If you come to that conclusion, then summary judgment is not appropriate, but I don't think that's a reasonable conclusion, and I hope to persuade you. So let me try to do that now.
Mr. Hyatt, before you go there, let me ask you, you know, it appears, I understand that it is your position that your clients are entitled to 100% of the property based on adverse possession.
Correct.
Based on the fact that the land was not included in the original estate in that probate, correct?
That's right.
And it was not passed through that probate. How do you address the In re Kaiʻina's estate case, that 1917 case that also refers back to Kaʻiʻilianu versus Lumai, an 1893 case, in which, you know, in the Kaiʻina case, this court noted that prior to the enactment of this probate statute, it had been the practice of the probate courts to decree the ownership of land and its division upon the heirs in settling the administration of intestate estates. But in Kaiʻina in 1917, the Hawaii Supreme Court said, in the case of Kaʻiʻilianu, which is the 1893 case, it was held to be a usurpation of jurisdiction, as neither by statute nor by precedent does such an authority exist. In other words, the probate court had no authority over real estate. And under the law at that time, land automatically divested to the heirs upon death.
I guess my response to that is I disagree with that as the applicable law. And
on what basis? Okay, in rebuttal, perhaps.
I guess what I'd like to do is focus on what I think are the facts in the applicable law for our position. We start with this Rule 303, which was before the court, and it states that there's a presumption that accompanies possession of real property, and a presumption imposes on the party against whom it is directed the burden of producing evidence. There was no doubt on this record that Kaʻiʻilianu land was in possession of the property. There was no evidence produced at the summary judgment proceeding to rebut that presumption of ownership. That's the first point. Second point goes to the record. This was the inventory of the probate proceeding, and it was done by Mr. Fraser in 1905. The inventory states what was in the estate and what was not in the estate. What was in the estate was this personal property, 10 shares in at a plantation, and what was not in the estate was the real estate, no real estate. That's repeated below that a certain Kuleana in the name of Kanoe Wai, situated at Pulehu near Mahukona, which belonged to the deceased, had upon information and belief been sold during the lifetime of Mr. Kaʻiʻilianu.
So he didn't have personal knowledge. That's what that says to me.
Okay. No, that's what it says to you. But I mean, that's...
No, well, I mean, it says based upon information. So he doesn't say that he was personally aware, that he'd seen the document, seen the deed, knew who it went to. He didn't know anything specifically. In fact, all we know is that, I don't mean to say he didn't know anything. I mean, all we know is that whatever he knew, it came based on information.
Okay. Fair enough. Let me kind of continue and see if I can persuade you, Justice. So that states none. And then the clerk, the same information was repeated to the clerk. These were the clerk's notes, which were yes. Sam Keanu made an appearance as a claimant to real estate, which he claims Kahowai owned and sold. Okay. Those were the clerk's minutes in the court record.
Is that dated February 2nd, 1906?
It was the clerk's minutes. This is March Yes, February 2nd. That's the top left.
And didn't he get the property 3 days earlier? Didn't he get from his mother, he got the property and a deed on January 29th. So he's saying that the property was sold, yet he gets the deed and the property from his mother 3 days earlier.
And I'm sorry, your point being?
Well, if it was sold, then how was he getting the property from his mother, unless his mother had inherited it?
Well, I guess my point, Your Honor, is that it appears now from the second court record that it was sold. And these deeds from his mother, I think, are wild deeds. But let me go to the third piece of evidence.
Okay, so then your whole premise is based on this property actually having been sold to a third party.
During
right?
his lifetime.
Right, yes. During his lifetime.
That is correct.
Where is that deed?
There is no deed.
What about the statute of frauds, which was in existence at the time?
Yes. Well, what about the question is, what about adverse possession? Because adverse possession is the basis upon which my client claims title.
You're claiming adverse possession because if you claim co-tenancy, you realize you have a problem.
Well,
right.
A,
so it is in your client's interest to claim adverse possession. So your adverse possession is based entirely on this deed, this transfer to someone else that took the property out of his intestate estate,
yeah,
putting aside the issue of the law that real property was not included in a probate estate at that time. Where is that deed? The statute of frauds does apply.
No, there is no deed on either side of the question, Your Honor, but there is strong evidence of adverse possession, which was uncontested below. And the argument of co-tenancy was made as an alternative argument,
right.
Not as the primary.
So if we do reach the issue of co-tenancy, my next question is, what would your percentage be?
50%.
Why?
Because we had deeds from 50% of the antecedent owners.
Okay.
And I don't think that was.
I thought it was 25%. Perhaps I'm wrong.
I'm not sure. Mr. Copper gets up.
I thought one heir didn't. Nothing happened.
I believe one heir passed away, and if I understood your argument was that at that point the property is cheated to the surrounding landowners, which would have, I guess, been the predecessors in interest of your client, although I think Mr. Copper's clients argue that that fact had not been established in the record. So there was a question of fact as to whether that escheat had occurred. That's my understanding.
But let me return you.
Because that person had died and had left some property in Maui, as I recall. And I'm just, you know, no one appeared on his line, right, in this case. So what happens if no one appears in his line in that case? Does his interest then get distributed amongst the other three? Or what happens to his estate? Does it escheat? I mean, what happens?
Our argument is that it escheats.
Okay.
This was the inventory. Again, it didn't list the property. Let's see if I can muscle these up. This was simply the order approving accounts in discharge. So this was the order in the lower court. And the order in the lower court discharged after the accounts which he submitted addition to having Fraser's inventory and his statement of none, we then have a court order based on that, and that said that that was not proper. And it seems to me it's hard to dodge a court order that states it as a matter of simple estoppel and collateral estoppel in the court's order.
Unless under the law at that time, intestate real estate was not a part of a probate estate.
But if that was the law at the time, that begs the question of why real property was listed in all of these documents. And it also begs this question. The power of attorney was granted by, these are all the heirs from which we purported to do the will deeds, all four of them. Power of attorney was granted to Holstein. In that power of attorney, they accepted the accounts from the estate. And they agreed that their distributive share was just these 10 shares of stock.
And Holstein got the property, too.
And Holstein got property, too.
But 4 months later.
Yeah. It's sort of like Brooklyn Bridge argument, I'm sorry to say. It's that simple from our point of view. But I mean, if you don't have title to it, you can't pass title to it, no matter that somebody accepts it, no matter that there's consideration.
Then why did your client feel any need to pay anything for his titled share?
Well, my client's primary claim was by adverse possession. I mean, this land was owned and operated at a ranch by Parker Ranch since the 60s, and that's all in the record.
But I think Mr. Smart, when he took his interest, didn't the deed that conveyed the interest to him indicate that it was at least a one-third interest in the property, or it indicated less than the possibility of less than a complete interest in the property? Isn't that right?
I think, yeah. The title reports showed what occurred. And I think anybody who's wise enough to read a title report would know it. And the question is, what's the legal effect?
But isn't that enough to put those who take after Mr. Smart on notice that there may be a co-tenancy and then trigger the obligation to provide actual notice to the co-tenants? And if not, why not?
Well, I think that this legal argument trumps that, and that's our position. And here's the last part of the puzzle. This master's report was done 7 years later, 1917. The master examined all of and audited the accounts of Fraser, and that included the issue of the property. And he recommended that the final accounts be approved and allowed, the same as rendered and presented in the file. So 1917. Still no mention of this property. Now, what would we do at trial? You know, guys, because I'll understand trials. Who's going to testify about that record, which is 100 years old? I don't think there's anybody to testify. I think you've got a set of facts, which is Arnie's court records, establishing, at least for collateral estoppel purposes, that there was no property in this estate at that time. Nobody is going to appear and testify about a deed, and we come to the ICA opinion.
But that's two different issues, whether or not the property was listed in the probate and whether or not he died owning the property. I mean, you have some responsibility. You're going to have to prove that there was a sale.
Well, and I think we did.
Well, I think, you know, when we look at all the evidence as to the sale, we don't know who it went to. There's no deed. There's a statute of frauds issue. We don't know the contents of the deed. I mean, you know, it could even have been sold to the people who inherited it, for all we know.
But they don't present any deed. And they didn't present any deed antecedent to the wild deeds that we've argued exist. I mean, if it had been sold to them, they would have been the first to do it. They signed.
Who's they?
These four.
They were the.
I'm sorry. My question was just that. Yeah. It's so theoretical. We don't know. I mean, you're postulating that this was sold, and the only evidence that it could be sold are some of these statements that you're putting in. And under the evidence code, it's conflicted by actions because the deeds, the way it was handled afterwards, doesn't coincide with what those statements say.
Well, the way it was handled afterwards is based on deeds that were created afterwards for which there's no record, similarly no record that they had any title to pass. That's
Well, they would have title unless the title had been conveyed away by their predecessor, right, by the decedent. So, I mean, absent the possibility of the property having been conveyed away, they would have acquired title as a matter of law by virtue of being his heirs. Whether or not, I think that was Justice McKenna's point earlier, whether or not the probate court adjudicated that, they would have acquired title as a matter of law under our case law.
And I will respond to that, Your Honor, but the point is, my response to that is that this estate listed potential real property, and it didn't list this as real property, and it purported to convey and distribute all the property that he had on multiple occasions, and it didn't list this property. So while that may be a view of the law, it sure isn't reflected by any record in this case. The records in this case on six or seven occasions reflect the property was affected.
Mr. Hyatt, I just have one small question.
Sure.
Were there recording laws in existence when David Kohoiwai died? Do they have any relevance to the issues raised on this appeal?
The recording laws?
Yeah.
Let me hit that on the
bubble. All right.
One other point. There was no outside interest in this property from the people now make a claim for the last 15 years. Nobody appeared. Nobody paid any taxes. All of it was done by the Parker Ranch or the current owners. Not until this claim to obtain clear title was made by my client was there any claim of an interest in this property. So I see that I'm near the end of my time. I would simply say this, that a trial has to be based on the evidence than the record. There is no more evidence than we have. This is a bench trial. And I think that this record is overwhelming.
Thank you, Mr. Hyatt. Mr. Copper, your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. As this court recognized in City and County of Honolulu versus Bennett, adverse possession has historically been used in Hawaii by the rich against the poor. Now, the modern trend under statutory and case law has been to disfavor adverse possession. Given this modern trend, summary judgment regarding adverse possession should be reserved for that rare case where there are absolutely no issues in dispute. This is not that case for three reasons. First, there are disputed issues of fact as to whether David Kohoiwai owned the property at the time of his death.
What do you think a remand for trial would do? Who's going to testify at this point? What additional evidence? What is an issue of fact? In other words, discovery is not going to help. Are you going to find additional witnesses at this point? No, right? Aren't we just dealing with issues of law at this point? How do we make sense of the facts that we do have?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, you know, on these types of cases, adverse possession on the summary judgment, case law is pretty clear that when there's close calls, such as it is in this case, where we have evidence on one hand in favor of the defendants and possible evidence in favor of the plaintiffs, that this should go to a trial. And you're also correct that this matter can be decided as a matter of law. For example, that their evidence is insufficient as a matter of law to prove that David sold, or that the orders of the probate court, in fact, are not binding as a matter of law. But there are disputed issues here. And really, the central issue in dispute is whether David owned the property. And this is because if he owned the property at the time of his death, all of the parties agree that plaintiffs and the McDougal family defendants would own the property together now as co-tenants. This would be critical to their adversary.
Is this because that under the law at that time, you didn't need intestate property, real estate did not go through probate, and it automatically went to the heirs as a matter of law?
Correct, Your Honor, and if I may skip ahead and address that. A case that plaintiff relies upon, in addition to the Cut Evans estate case, is also Mossman versus the Point of And this is real telling here, because the question before that court was, can first, is the determination of heirs as to the personal property of the estate also binding upon the real property of that same estate? And this court answered that question in the negative. And in fact, none of the laws in place at the time of David's death required that the entirety of an estate be administered and distributed in one proceeding. And really, to hold otherwise would reach an illogical conclusion, that you can simply unown property by failing to include it in a probate inventory. So first, we can, you know, I think there's two ways to look at plaintiff's probate evidence. One is—
Mr. Comper, there's evidence that the property was specifically excluded in the inventory. Isn't that a different situation than if they didn't include it?
No, Your Honor, and I think this is an excellent point, though, because, again, under Mossman, it's not required to include the property. And then when we look at the documents relied upon by plaintiff, we can see that this probate proceeding was specifically for the personal property of the estate. For example, plaintiff relies upon this power of attorney document, and it's found at page 639 of the record. In this document, David's heirs make their opinion appearance, and then they appoint this H.L. Holstein as their attorney in fact. Theirs then say that they appoint Mr. Holstein, quote, in our name to ask, recover, and receive under from the Circuit Court, Third Circuit of the Territory of Hawaii probate, all our distributive share in the personal estate. It does not refer to the real estate. And in fact, they titled themselves as next of kin, which at the common law referred to claimants to a personal estate of a decedent, not the real estate. Plaintiffs also rely upon this master's report. Master's report makes the same note. He says, in checking up the records in the said matter, and more particularly with the amount of money deposited with this court as being the personal property of the estate. And there's nothing wrong with that. As we see in Mossman, you can have a probate of a portion of the estate, just the personal property. And I'll leave open the question of the real property. And this could be decided in Mossman. It was an injected action. I believe it could also be decided in a quiet title lawsuit.
Mr. Copper, what do you think the trial's going to look like? I mean, what evidence are you going to...
Well, in this case, plaintiff will have the burden, even at trial, to prove their case. Because this is adverse possession...
Do you really want a trial?
The McDougal family wants to protect their land, and if a trial is what it takes, then that's what it takes. But, in cases before this court, like Morneau versus Roy, this court has recognized that when you have adverse possession on summary judgment, it's not something that can be just done easily.
Let me ask this. Why did you not move for a cross motion for summary judgment in this case?
I think you're correct, Your Honor. It's hard to speculate, but indeed, the facts, especially considering the law, could support.
Let me reword it. Would a cross motion for summary judgment be appropriate on this record or not, in your point of view?
It could, based on the law regarding the sufficiency of the evidence relied upon by plaintiffs, if I may. In order to prove title in yourself by way of a lost deed, this court recognized in Kapunia versus Keikupu that the law is undoubted that it will be necessary that there should be presented clear proof of the execution of the deed and proof of its content sufficient to enable the court to determine the character of the instrument. So whatever evidence has come forward, at least at a matter of law, is not sufficient because we do not know the contents of the deed. So I think that could support a motion for summary judgment based on this principle of Kapunia versus Keikupu. And further, plaintiff's failure to meet the standard to prove the contents of this deed also gives rise to issues of fact. For example, plaintiffs are relying upon...
Well, what about the statute of frauds?
I think that's a good point, Your Honor. It wasn't raised in this case, but...
Some of your clients that were represented by different counsel did raise statute of frauds as an affirmative defense in their answer.
That is correct, Your Honor. And the other clients submitted more simple answers. But I think that is a basis upon which a trial court can make a ruling on summary judgment. And also, Judge Perkins noted, what was the notice statutes at the time of David's death? And it's my understanding that it is a regular notice statute where if you're a good faith purchaser and you do not have actual knowledge of a prior deed, a deed executed later in time but recorded first can win out. It's another issue which, you know, should go before the trial court here. If I may go back to my point.
Well, let's come back to the statute of frauds. Do you think the statute of frauds supports your client's position? And I noted you had actually argued the lost deed doctrine. So at one point you were arguing that although there wasn't a deed, one might still infer that a deed existed, but in this circumstances here there wasn't enough evidence to support that. And then statute of frauds is a very different theory, which is no deed, I guess no conveyance might be a very blunt way of putting it. So which of those two is it? Are they compatible, or would you, or is it one or the other?
Yes, Your Honor, I think they are compatible. You know, this lost deed theory really is a real specific exception. It goes back to a time of Hawaiian antiquity where deeds were sometimes lost or misplaced. And so Kapunia, the court did recognize, okay, you know, we need to have a rule specifically for this situation where deeds are lost, because it seemed to have happened from time to time, especially with the Native community, as was recognized in that case. However, I think, and this aligns with the statute of frauds, is that in order to prove this lost deed, you have to prove it, I mean, to the T, what were the actual contents? In fact, in Kapunia'i, this court went so far as to ask, what was the weather like the day this deed was signed? We know none of that here. And really, that's what it comes down to is, yes, it's insufficient as a matter of law, but also, you know, their failure to meet the standard gives rise to issues of fact. Because without knowing the contents of the deed, their evidence now is ambiguous and does, you know, present issues of fact.
What is your client's position as to the law, as to Pahukula's interest?
Well, Your Honor, the court below did not go so far, but it would be plaintiff's burden to prove, in fact, that Pahukula had no one who could take his interest, which...
Well, he obviously left his Maui property to a son or something like that, correct? He had a will, but if... that was in 1910, so obviously the law still was that if this was an intestate real estate, it went to his heirs. But there was a publication or... And no one came forward for Pahukula, is that correct? In this case, okay, so if no one came forward for Pahukula in this case, as a matter of law, what happened to his interest? To his interest?
Because, as Your Honor recognized through cases like In re Estate of Kaiana, it would vest in his heirs. And because, you know, I think we can look at this situation where David died, leaving brothers, that is David Kaho'iwai. His interest went to his siblings as well as his niece. And assuming that there are siblings or nieces still alive at the time of Pahukula's death, it would go to them. But so at minimum...
Assuming it went to them, but I see. And assuming that there are such heirs alive at this time.
Correct, and that would be plaintiff's burden to show at trial if this were to go at least with determination based on paper time.
To show that they, assuming there's a co-tenancy, to show that they gave notice?
Well, that too, but I was more specifically referring, assuming as to the SG issue, they would need to prove that Pahukula died without any takers, and they in fact were the owners of the surrounding
Does the record now contain evidence to resolve that issue on summary judgment or not, in your view?
You know, I cannot say 100%. I'm not certain. I would like to address two documents and affirmative statements relied upon by plaintiff. And this goes to what happens when you don't prove the contents of this lost deed. For example, they rely upon the inventory of David's estate, which was prepared by the administrator, Mr. E.A. Frazier, who was a creditor. Justice Pollack recognized that this statement was made on information and belief. Because we do not know the contents of this deed, there is an ambiguity, an issue of fact. For example, he states that the certain Kuleana 8723 in the name of Kaho Iwai, situated at Palehu, belonged to the deceased had upon information been sold during lifetime of said Kaho Iwai. An issue that needs to be determined by the trial court is which Kaho Iwai, because there were two. David's father went by the singular name Kaho Iwai, singular names being at least common in the time of antiquity. In 1885, Kaho Iwai the senior sold the property to David. However, at the time, David went by the name Ka'ehu Okekai. He did not go by the name of David. So
wait. He sold it in 1885?
David's father, Kaho Iwai. So there are two Kaho Iwais. David's father's name was Kaho Iwai.
What year was the royal patent? 1891?
No, it should be, I believe, in the 1850s.
Oh, I see. Okay, sorry.
Right. So Kaho Iwai sold it. Kaho Iwai the senior, David's father, sold it to David, who went by the name of Ehu Okekai. This deed is on record. It was dated in April of 1885. And we know that this was the only deed on record at the time of David's death, because there is no deed from David. So therefore, when we look at the statement, there's an issue of fact here. Which Kaho Iwai is Mr. E.A. Frazier referring to? Or is Mr. Frazier confused as to which Kaho Iwai sold the property in 1885?
Well, what kind of evidence would you bring forth if it were to go to trial to prove or disprove the statements about the property?
Well,
it's a question of fact, but how is that going to be resolved at trial?
Well, the trial court would have to look at this evidence and determine which Kaho Iwai sold it. I think when we look at the totality of the evidence that's already before this court, a finding can be made in the favor of the McDougal family. Because while we not only have the statement by Mr. Frazier, there's also the clerk's deeds. And I think this is a sticking point. And I apologize, the clerk's minute. Okay, at 592 of the record. The clerk says, Sam Keanu makes an appearance as a claimant to real estate which he claims Kaho Iwai owned and sold. Why would a man go into court and say, I own this property, but I don't because my predecessor sold it? I think the more reasonable inference can be made is that when he says Kaho Iwai owned and sold, he's talking about Kaho Iwai the senior. And these are issues of fact, again, which come up as a result.
So how would a trial help resolve that? Who's going to testify as to that intent?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, because of the age of this probate, it would most likely have to be done based on the record. But here the record at least supports such a finding. Now,
I guess the question would be, as a matter of law, would the ruling be clear either in favor of the plaintiffs or the defendants, or is it your position that it cannot be said determinatively as a matter of law either that summary judgment should have been granted for the plaintiffs or could be granted for the defendants? And accordingly, as often happens when they're in dispute, when the few facts are in dispute, the matter has to go to trial. Is that where we're at in this case?
If I may, I think it's a little of both. Because there's, I guess, two separate ways of looking at it. When we look at the laws regarding the probate court and the sufficiency of evidence proving a lost deed, that's something that can be dealt with on summary judgment.
And statute of frauds,
thank you. But also, you know, if this were to go down to the evidence, that is, if the trial court would be permitted to look at the evidence from the probate of David's estate, to take something from that, then it will have to go down to their evidence versus the evidence of the McDougal family, which at least based on, you know, the most reasonable interpretation of the evidence, could likely go in their favor.
Is it your client position on behalf of your clients that if there's a co-tenancy, your clients or at least some of your clients, whoever it would be, own 50%?
Correct, Your Honor, at minimum. And again, it would need to be determined what happened to Pahukula's share when David's property, and whether or not his interest did eschew to. Now, if I may,
So the law would be, based on the law at that time, if there was an escheat, it would have been to the owner of the ili, or the ahupua'a.
Correct, that is what I understand.
And we don't have evidence as to who the owner of the ili or ahupua'a was. And what does it mean by, because this was an undivided interest, right? So it would be who owned the ili around this 11 point something acres.
Correct, and I don't want to put words in or arguments in plaintiff's mouth. So I'm not sure exactly what they would claim is their evidence as to why, it was cheap. But you're correct. It would come down to, under the law at the time, it's cheap to the surrounding ahupua'a owner, and that would need to be proved by that. If I may, there was an issue about deeds. And, in fact, there is discussion about Hawaii rules of evidence and presumption of, taking owner, acting as if you're an owner of land. And this, in fact, is the evidence which the McDougal family has provided, that David did own the property. Because, as we said, in 1885, Kahoʻiwai the senior sold the property to David, and there's no deeds of record by David. Instead, there are three deeds which are executed by David's heirs. And I think it is important to note that recitals contained in two of those deeds purport that the grantors were vested with title by intestate succession. If I may, in 1907, Kanoiaina Sniffen conveyed her interest in the property to the McDougal family's predecessors. This is at 583 of the record. In it, Ms. Sniffen says that the property was first deeded to David, then quote, and which was inherited by said grantor, she being a sister of said Kaʻehu o Ke Kaiū died intestate in December 13, 1903, and known at Mahukona as David Hukai Kokoʻiwai. Now David's other heir, Pua, in her deed to H.L. Holstein, the English translation located at 724 of the record stated, we received through inheritance as blood relatives of Kaʻehu o Ke Kai, who died without a will. Now, under Maui Land and Pineapple versus Infiesto, this court recognized that recitals contained in the deed and which purport that the grantor was vested with title of fee simple by way of intestate succession was sufficient to prove the same. In fact, in that case, it was sufficient to prove summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff. So really our inquiry can end here at minimum because we have an issue of fact that David, in fact, owned the property based on these recitals. Now, I would also argue that the execution of the deeds themselves are evidence. This court recognized in Morneau versus Roy that a deed by a grantor's widow was evidence that the grantor did not convey complete title to the property as issued in that case in his lifetime. And in fact, this evidence was a basis upon which the court found a genuine issue as to whether the parties are co-tenants. There's also that City and County of Honolulu versus Bennett case. The court there at least recognized the persuasive effect of a party's to a deed or grant and its successors in interest's construction of that deed in determining the effect of it. So for example, here, by executing deeds to the property, David's heirs acted as if this purported deed to a third party either did not convey complete title or did not exist, and instead acted as if title descended to them by way of intestate succession through David. Plaintiff's predecessors acted in a similar way. There's a recognition about a deed from Joseph Isaacs, where Joseph Isaacs warranted his interest in the property. And of course, for the 90 years after Samuel Keanu, who was David's nephew, when he deeded the property to plaintiff's predecessors, Joseph Isaacs, plaintiff and his predecessors acted as if title in fact descended from David to his heirs. And they acted as if this purported deed to some third party that went unrecorded either was not sufficient to grant to transfer complete title, or in fact did not exist. So if there's no further questions, that's all my presentation. I just wanted to close with a point.
Okay. There was a conveyance from the Smart Trust to the Parker Trust.
In 1961?
Which reflected a TMK, the proper TMK number, but the wrong land commission award number. Instead of, all throughout it has been land commission award 8723, but that one referenced a Land Commission Award 8098, which is actually an adjoining property, and I'm wondering what, if any, would be the legal effect of that wrong designation of the land?
No, Your Honor, I did not pick up on that, but I would say that, you know, a material term of a deed under Hornbook law is you have to prove the location and the boundaries of the deed. So I guess that would go to, was there an ambiguity as to which property was being conveyed?
And is there an effect in your view, or is there, what significance is there of the fact that, if I understand correctly, Joseph Osecki, when he deeded the property to Mr. Smart, deeded all of his undivided interest, representing not less than a one-third undivided interest in and to the property. Does that, in your view, raise any issues of fact regarding whether his understanding was that he might have had less than a full ownership of the property?
It does, Your Honor. That's a great point, because really what this discussion about did David sell or not comes down to an issue of co-tenancy. And so that deed from Joseph Isaacs or Ezekiel really put plaintiff on notice that, hey, there are co-tenants here. So if you want to claim this property in full, you need to act in good faith, and you need to bring home notice as required, beginning with the City and County of Honolulu versus Bennett case. And clearly that's something that plaintiff cannot prove here. And in fact, on the record below at page 485, they recognize that if the court finds that the property was not sold prior to David Hukai Kaho'iwai's death in 1903, then plaintiff has paper title to a one-half interest in the property, and the McDougal defendants have pro rata the remaining one-half. So they recognize that their adverse possession claim will fail if they cannot prove that, in fact, David Kaho'iwai sold the property prior to his death. And of course, none of the facts on the record could support such an argument. But just in closing, you know, it has been recognized that adverse possession laws really were tightened by the 1978 Constitutional Convention. And the delegates there recognize that it's a sad fact, indeed, that adverse possession has been and still is being used as a method for stealing property from the poor, particularly the Hawaiians. Now, thankfully, the world has turned here. And this court, along with amendments to the Constitution, has made adverse possession much more difficult. Plaintiff bears an incredibly heavy burden to prove their case, especially on summary judgment, and especially when there are possible co-tenants. You know, what happened in this case, to me, illustrates really what happens without these modern protections, where this family can just lose their land, even though all of the deeds out there in the universe tells us that they own it, even though ancient testimony tells us they own it, even though the plaintiff's own actions tells us that this family still owns their fair share of their property. You know, I think there's cultural traditions at play here in Hawaii which attach really a fundamental importance to keeping family land with the family. And I don't think these interests can just be cast aside based on a thin summary judgment record here. The McDougal family is entitled at least to a trial to protect their land. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Copper. Mr. Hyatt, your rebuttal.
So let me start, please, just to try to answer a couple of questions that Justice Perkins asked. I looked through the record, Justice, and found that, for example, at Exhibit Q, there was a registrar of conveyances for one of the deeds in question, and that's dated 1908. So at least around this time, there were recorded deeds. Then I wanted to address the question of these issues of fact. And just remind the court that the transcript of 52620 at pages 12 to 14, and this is cited at pages 11 and 12 of our brief to the ICA seeking cert. Counsel for all of the defendants acknowledged that there were no additional facts. Mr. Schultz said, right now I'm not aware of additional facts. Ms. Kalama said at this point there's no real issues of fact. But it's our position that the court can rule as a matter of law.
does the record reflect who the owner of the Ili was, or Ali Fu'a, if there's an issue of Pahukula's interest?
I don't know. But I think you cited in the briefs the doctrine of judicial estoppel, and I don't think that counsel can come here and claim issues of fact when he didn't appeal. Sorry, I don't think you can. That's, again, I'm sure. Well,
and in terms of the conveyance from the Smart Trust to the Parker Trust, reflecting a different land commission award number, which is the adjoining parcel, but the correct TMK number, does that have any legal effect?
I think it's probably, I'm aware from other cases, Your Honor, that if there's a mistake like that in title and it's just a typo because it's the wrong thing, it can be corrected by a correction deed, and it does not affect, it doesn't operate to,
I mean, does the TMK take precedence over the land commission award description? I'm not quite sure what the law is on that.
Usually that would be handled by a correction deed, just like if there's a meets and bounds error in your lot. But that's long ago practical real problem. So let me hit a couple of other things. Council has done what he should. He's argued the equities. But there are equities on the other side. This is my client's home. He paid very significant sum for it. He bought it in good faith from Parker Ranch. Parker Ranch, in turn, did occupy it. The parties who are seeking it now haven't paid dime for property taxes or made a claim to it.
Is this ranch land or a home?
Second. It's ranch land, but it's part of his own, about 300 acres. 300 acres total, and that's where John lives. And he was, would have been branding this today, except for being here. And it's not, I don't think it's appropriate to come in and assert that there's an emotional content here when we don't have some court record. We've got a record of multiple instances where a court said this property was not in the estate.
Isn't that what Mr. Smart did by taking a property that he knew was one-third and then deciding on his own to convey the entirety of the property? Took it knowing it was one third?
Yeah, I don't know, Mr. Smart. I don't know what he did. But I think that at this stage of history, what we do have is an unambiguous court record saying Mr. Kobe Bai did not own the property. That's the point I wanted to make, which is the ICA's opinion.
I'm sorry, were you going to address my initial question as to the law at the time?
Yeah, and I didn't find anything.
This wasn't all that long ago. I mean, we're talking about a historical property that conveyance by Mr. Smart was 1988 or something relatively recent. Is that right?
That is the conveyance by Mr. Smart. That's not the time at which Parker Ranch occupied the land. Parker Ranch occupied the land long before that. And the record of adverse possession is from at least 1961, but it probably preceded that.
But as I understand, that issue doesn't come up unless you prove a sale. So we get back to whether or not a sale can be proved.
Yeah. And then let me just speak to that for a moment, because the ICA opinion said it too, page 2, the record undisputedly supports the fact that Davis heirs received no interest to the property through the probate process. And
is that dispositive? I mean, we have a probate code and probate rules that say if things aren't listed, there's a way when the property gets discovered and it hasn't been listed to remedy it.
Yes.
And we wouldn't have those rules and statutes unless it was clear that if something isn't listed, it isn't automatically resolved because it's not listed.
But it was listed. And I don't want to argue with you. I just want to point out that it was. This probate tried to take account of this property. And it, on multiple occasions, reviewed by the master 7 years later, there are these statements that there was no property in this estate. The statement that it was a different Kohoi Bai, I think, is a great argument, but this was the estate of David Kohoi Bai, and that statement was made in the context of trying to list the property and assets of David Kohoi Bai, and that statement was then reviewed by a master 7 years later dealing with Kohoi Bai, and I don't think it's a fair argument to say that we're talking about a different deed or the father.
potentially ambiguous statement of Kaho'olai could relate to different people, but it's in this particular estate, so why would it relate to the other yeah. person? But isn't that still a question of fact that needs to be resolved by the judge?
I don't, you know, the rule is a genuine issue of material fact. Okay? It's not a genuine issue of material fact in my book, because it's raised for the first time in this argument today and wasn't raised below. And if counsel stood in front of trial court below and said there are no such issues, and you've heard that one for the first time today, so you can't do that, I don't think. And that's really all I'm going to have to say. Any other questions?
Are there any other questions from the court? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Hyatt, Mr. Copper. We appreciate your arguments today, and the court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.